So, Chris, big week.
Yeah.
Vanity Fair Oscar party
biggest
was this past
week of
weekend.
The year, I think.
So, tell me about it. Your world that you cover is far more interesting than the political world that I cover. So, give me the hot goss. Who was the most interesting, the most surprising, all of it?
I don't know if it's more interesting. Actually, there are some intersection points because I was at the Vanity Fair Oscar party and who waltzed in but Nancy Pelosi, looking regal and gorgeous and very at home in Hollywood. Very much a space that I feel like she feels comfortable in.
I could see that. So I interviewed her a couple years ago, and I've never felt the need to sit up straighter in an interview with, like, anyone.
Oh, that's so funny.
And she's in this new chapter in her life where she's, you know, she's no longer speaker. Mm-hmm. She's kind of living it up.
Letting her hair down even, yeah. You know. Yeah. I didn't talk to her per se, you know, but I did see her, you know, bopping around, you know, making the rounds.
I would love to, like, be a fly on the wall for any of those conversations. Pelosi talking to Kate Blanchett, like Michael B. Jordan, all of it. That's just very, that's very exciting to me.
Yeah.
Sort of this collision of our worlds.
Yeah. You know, they rarely intertwine, but when they do, you know, things can really pop off. It can be really special.
And she's definitely one of the few people who I think could survive and thrive in that environment. Like, you're not going to see, like, Chuck Grassley, like, rubbing elbows.
You're listening to a special bonus episode of Inside the Hive,
where Vanity Fair writers tackle the week's news in politics, media, and entertainment.
I'm Chris Murphy, a staff writer at Vanity Fair, covering entertainment and popular culture for the Hollywood section.
And I'm Abigail Tracy, the national political reporter at Vanity Fair.
This is the latest in a series of bonus episodes with Vanity Fair writers from in and outside the Hive. It's in addition to the regularly scheduled programming from co-hosts Joe Hagan and Emily Jane Fox. In this episode, we're looking at how Gen Z, does politics in Washington, D.C., and what this means for the gerontocracy currently running the place. And I think, like, the best place to start, and the person I'm absolutely so fascinated by, who I think is so cool and, like, boggles my mind, is Maxwell Frost, the youngest Congress member from Florida, who you, Abby, wrote an incredible profile of that was so fantastic.
It was definitely fun. So just a little background on Maxwell Frost. So he's from Florida.
Yeah.
As you said, he filled the seat of Val Demings, who ran against Marco Rubio for Senate. She did not win, but he filled her seat in Congress. And he is, as you said, the first Gen Z member. So he was elected at 25 years old.
Wow. Could you imagine? Could you imagine?
No. I was such a mess. I can't do policy at 25. Like, I can't
run
even
a campaign and, you know, get actual adults to vote for me. That's absolutely absurd.
Absolutely. Absolutely absurd. I don't even think at 25 I could have gotten my parents to vote for me.
But what is his platform? What does he stand for? Why was he elected?
So he actually had quite a competitive primary, Democratic primary. So he won the seat by a lot, but, like, there was a very active, like, primary, and a lot of what he ran on were these really progressive things.
If we want bold change on guns, reproductive health, and affordable housing, we can't keep electing the same politician.
But also, you know, he does very much still fall into that, you know, Medicare for all, kind of those, like, the Bernie Sanders, like, just like to kind of, like, contextualize
totally
it,
know
you know. So he fell into that, like, student debt, like very progressive ideas that you're seeing from, you know, from the AOCs, from, you know, Bernie Sanders, you know, all of these individuals who've kind of adopted that sort of progressive lane. Like, that's very much where he falls
in his
policies, in his politics. He's there, you know,
he's
like
right there.
There.
He's right there. Okay, he's there. I have to imagine, right, that there are probably a lot of reasons that 25-year-olds are not often elected to Congress, right? Can you tell me about, like why it's kind of unusual for, like, a 25-year-old to make it all the way to D.C.?
The unique thing about Maxwell Frost is he dove into activism at such a young age. Mm. You know, if you're going to a vigil, you know, as a 14-year-old after a mass shooting and are pushing for gun control, like, he just kind of was ahead of the game.
Yeah.
There's a sheen and, like, a professionalism to him that I think is rare among 25-year-olds, not even 25-year-olds, just, like, people.
People, okay.
Yeah, and he's been an organizer for a very long time. And I think when you're an organizer, like, you understand, you have to understand how to communicate and how to bring people together. And, you know, that's kind of where his chops are. Like, that's kind of...
That was his nexus, that was his origin story, and that's,
I mean,
that goes part and parcel with politics, it feels.
Yeah, and because of that experience that he had, you know, he was able to translate that into a successful campaign where he is able to, you know, share these messages, be like articulate around like, okay, what do I stand for?
Yeah.
And I think a lot of politicians, like even ones who have been incumbents for ever, like don't necessarily have that skill set.
Yes.
Tomando acción. Aprobando leyes de control de almas. Protegiendo el acceso al aborto.
My abuela taught me early on to always look out for my community because everyone deserves dignity and opportunity.
So he's very impressive for his age. So he's actually technically not the youngest member ever elected. So Madison Cawthorn.
Oh, yeah, him.
Yes. Oof. He was 25 when he was elected, but he was technically a millennial. Mm-hmm. And now Maxwell Frost is Gen Z. So yes. He's the first of this generation. It's kind of like a new era in Congress. And
totally.
You also have, as we talked a little bit about, Nancy Pelosi. Mm-hmm. So she stepped aside. There's a new generation of leadership in the House.
Yeah, right, because Dianne Feinstein's, you know, she's retiring. Nancy's stepping down. It feels like there's a turnover that's beginning to happen. And Maxwell is sort of like the face of it for the Democratic Party. Was that your impression of him from interviewing him?
Absolutely. So it was fascinating. So the idea was really to like follow him around for the first couple days of the 118th Congress. And the night he was supposed to get sworn in, so it took days. It took until like Saturday. But the night he was supposed to originally get sworn in, he had a swearing in concert.
Yeah, that seems unusual to say the least.
Yes, absolutely.
You got to get ready. Y'all got a drink?
And so we go to this place right off, like, it's called The Wharf in D.C., and it was this concert venue. And we go into, like, the basement, the music is thumping, like, there's a bar, there's, like, tables with pizza, all of it, and he's throwing a concert. Like,
truly a concert with live music. You
live
know.
Music. Mm-hmm. It was crazy.
So to celebrate him being sworn in, even though he hasn't been sworn in yet, right?
Yes, but there was a concert. And so the interesting thing about him is he's super into music. He's a drummer. His dad is a musician.
Wow.
And he launched Music Festival in Orlando a long time ago. But so you saw that side of him.
Yes.
Like he was sort of flitting between MC and congressman.
And congressman.
So when I spoke with him, he's 26 now, but he really, you know, he talked about these moments and sort of the social moments, the geopolitical moments that kind of shaped who he is and who he is now, obviously, as a member of Congress. And he mentioned, you know, remembering being a kid and watching Occupy Wall Street.
Wow.
And, you know, then Barack Obama, you know, winning the presidency. But really, like, a huge part of what shaped him is gun violence.
Wow.
So and he, yeah.
It, Florida, too. I mean, that, like, you know, Parkland, there's a lot of.
Exactly.
A lot of examples.
So after the shooting in Connecticut, he went up there by himself. He went to, like, a vigil hosted by a brother of one of the victims. And he was very young at this time. I might botch the age. I think he was, like, 14.
Wow.
So he was very young when he got into this, into activism, into gun, you know, gun control, pushing for tighter restrictions and all of that. So he has his background as an activist. And he, you know, he talked about the various things that he's been a part of. Black Lives Matter, he got arrested, you know. He's just, that is what his background is. It's in activism. And when Val Demings announced that she was going to run for higher office, she ran for Senate, he had people around him that were like, you should run. And he told me that his initial reaction was, hell no.
Really?
And then it was like, you know, they planted the seed and it obviously grew into a congressional campaign that he then won. And so that's kind of who he is today. And those experiences that he had at a very young age are sort of what's shaping him and who he is as a member of Congress now.
It's so interesting to hear what experiences are shaping or shaped his sort of political agenda or his, you know, his activism.
I think, like, the real key is sort of his perspective in these things, these moments that have shaped him and sort of how they run in contrast to so many other members of Congress and his party. Like, they're, you know, these are in a, they're members of Congress who are, like, remember, I mean, JFK getting assassinated.
Yeah,
like, I don't,
no,
you know, they're old people.
They're old. There are plenty of old
not
people.
Not
ageist.
To be,
we're
ageist,
not being ageist.
Not saying that. But just, like, very different things, like, very different moments that sort of shaped their policies and sort of, like, their approach to being members of Congress. And he just has a whole new set of those.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the fascinating part about him and sort of what he represents as this new generation of change in Congress.
Yeah. And, like, I think a part of that, too, is how he expresses his political beliefs and his agenda in terms of social media and tweeting and Instagram and, you know, all of these things that, you know, are now pervasive in culture and society. Everyone uses social media, but he just has such a fluency, you know, such a funny way of expressing not only his, you know, political beliefs, but also like his taste in music. Like, you know, I follow him on Twitter and he's just like tweeting out links to like, you know, like different songs. And, you know, he retweeted a Maggie Rogers song the other day. And I was like, wait, that's so great. So he's able to do both of these things in a way that, like, even, you know, for young Congress members like the Squad and AOC, Ilhan Omar, you know, it's different. It feels different from him than it does from other people.
Yeah, because he has had social media his whole life. Mm. Like that, like he, middle school, high school, he's just been, you know, that's something that's so innate to like his existence, which is terrifying. Like, I feel bad
scary. I would not wish that upon anyone.
Right. Like, I feel bad that he had to suffer through that world. But it's organic. And it's organic in a way that is just notable, and you can tell the difference. Like, there isn't anything forced. Like, you know, he'll post Instagram stories and it's just natural. Like, he'll share music on Instagram and it's just, that's what he's listening to. It doesn't feel forced, you know. It's not like Obama, you know, throwing together his like Spotify playlist where it's like, you know, it's curated.
That's crowdsourced, and we can say that and we love it. It's a good playlist, but like, he's not, I don't believe that he's, you know, necessarily listening to all the tracks, you know, that, you know, Megan Thee Stallion and Lil Nas X. Maybe he is, but it seems like he's crowdsourcing.
Right. Like, you see Maxwell Frost post something on Instagram and you're like, yeah, I believe you were just listening to that song.
There's an idea that like your, you know, your political or your, you know, your professional life has to be so separate from like your personal life and your, you know, your music tastes and your passions. And I think he's showing that actually the next generation, it's like they can be one and the same. You know, he's this, you know, this this person who, yeah, you can like Ariana Grande and also be a gun control advocate, right? Why can't you have both?
Exactly. And I think you hit on something really interesting where it's like there's this sanitization that like happens with like most politicians, like where you feel that they're actively separating the professional from the personal. And with him, there's like no barrier.
And it's so refreshing. And it's making politics like, you know, exciting again. It's been a while, honestly. Since the days of AOC, you know, it's been a while since we've had or I've felt emotionally connected to a, you know, a candidate in such a way.
Inside the Hive will be back in just a moment.
Hi, it's Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you love digging into the week's political headlines, subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our reporters take you behind the scenes of some of the biggest stories from the campaign trail to the halls of Congress. Just for our Inside the Hive listeners, save 15% on a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair with promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off 1 year of all you can read, watch, and hear.
Do Democrats feel as strongly about Maxwell Frost as I seem to feel about Maxwell Frost?
So I will say that he has gotten a warm welcome on Capitol Hill. So at his swearing-in concert, I was shocked by the number of various, like, members of Congress who were there. So you had members of leadership show up, which was unique. So you had like the number two and number three members of Democratic leadership show up.
Okay, wow.
And then you also had, you know, older, like Sheila Jackson Lee got on stage and was like dancing with like Maxwell Frost. And then you had, you know, sort of his group of younger members as well. You had like David Cicilline. Like there was just a mix of so many different people. Like, and then also like Reverend Jesse Jackson popped by. So it's like, so there was just like this, it felt different. Like it felt, I think I have been fortunate enough to cover other members of Congress. We mentioned the Squad. And there was a different kind of friction or tension when they came to Congress. And I think, you know, in many ways that they paved the way for Maxwell Frost.
You can't, I feel like you can't get a Maxwell Frost if you don't have the Squad, if you don't have, you know, AOC and Rashida and Ilhan and, you know, Ayanna, right?
Yeah. And so like they definitely paved the way for him. But I think there's been sort of a seamlessness to his welcome in Congress. And I think a lot of it goes to, you know, who he is as a person. He's very likable. He's cool.
I do want to ask, and I do think it is important that, you know, given Maxwell's warm reception or relatively warm reception or warmer than the squad, it feels like gender has to play a role in that, right? Because, he, you know, he is a cisgendered man and, you know, the squad is, you know, all women, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how did you see that dynamic play out?
Yeah, I think, you know, there was, when you think about the squad and sort of when they came to Congress, it was different. One, like you had Ayanna Pressley and Ocasio-Cortez, they beat out Democratic incumbents. Mm-hmm. So they beat Democrats' friends, like people that they had worked with for like decades and knew. So it was like, so that they had that coming in. But there was also, there was definitely this undercurrent of like sexism in so much that was happening. I mean, you know, the way in which you saw Ocasio-Cortez get like death threats and just like, you know, very sexist threats, like attacks, you know, it was like a different level of vitriol that was very entwined with her gender. And obviously with Maxwell Frost, you don't have that.
Yeah.
Like, it is different. So not only did they pave the way for Maxwell Frost, but also that was just an element that he hasn't had to deal with in a way that they did. And it's not that he's not getting judgment for being young, or he's probably being criticized for the fact that he is accessible on social media and all of this. Like, you can never please anybody, especially in politics. But I think it is sort of fascinating to see the difference over these last couple years in terms of the fact that the Democratic Party and these other members that were there, they were excited about Maxwell Frost. And they view him as, you know, this new bridge to a new generation. And when I was speaking with him, he said something that really stuck with me. He was like, it's not that Gen Z has been like champing at the bit, like waiting to get into Congress. He's like, we literally just got old enough.
Yeah.
And he's like, but he said, we just got old enough and we're already here. Like, Gen Z isn't waiting. And I do think that there is something about, you know, this new generation of leaders, like of activists, of individuals, that it's kind of exciting.
I want to ask you, too, about Frost's financial struggles that he's really open about, too. And did you talk to him about that at all?
Yeah. So he, you know, his resume, you know, he worked at like the ACLU and he worked for, I'm blanking on the name right now, but the organization that was started by the Parkland kids, you know, gun control. Like, these aren't very like lucrative things to work for. And like, during his congressional campaign, you know, he would hop in a car and drive Uber. Like, that was what he was doing.
Wow.
Like, he, you know, like, by day, he's like running for Congress. By night, he's picking you up.
Yeah.
And so I think he, and again, he's 26 years old. Like, it's not like he's going to be flush with cash at this age. But so it was like, there was kind of this interesting not dust up, but like, you know, when he came to D.C., you know, he had been elected. It was like during the gap of like when he was elected to like when he actually was sworn in. And he tried to get an apartment in D.C. and he got rejected. He got turned down because his credit score wasn't good enough,
wasn't high enough.
And, you know, he talked about the fact, like, he was very open about it. He's like, look, he hurt his credit, like, when he was running for Congress. Like, this happens.
Campaigns are expensive.
Exactly. And he was very open about it. And it's just sort of one of these things where, one, you kind of think, like, you could go to the landlord and be like, hey, guys, like, just, you know, like, I'm going to have a really good job in January.
Trust me, once the dust settles with the whole McCarthy of it all, like, I'm good to go.
Exactly. Like, because, you know, members of Congress, like, you basically have to live in two places when
you have to live in your
Congress.
District, you have to live in your, you know, you have to represent your district, but you also have to be in D.C. And that's that is financially, and I mean, not to go back to the macro of like Congress in general, but there's a reason, I think, why a lot of Congress is a lot older, because to be able to live that lifestyle, you sort of have to have the funds and the means and the ability to do that. And not every 25-year-old, you know, can make that happen.
Having financial struggles is such a normal, relatable
American thing. It is a normal American, relatable problem.
I don't wish financial struggles on anybody, but it's I think it's great that you have people in Congress who can understand that and, you know, understand the challenges that people go through, not just like running for office, but in general, like getting an apartment is hard.
Yeah.
You know?
You know, we've been focusing on Maxwell and the Democratic Party. Are there any corollaries in the Republican Party?
There was sort of like a fostering of younger talent within the Republican Party that was kind of absent from the Democratic Party for a while there. I hate to say young guns, but like we all remember the young guns,
yeah.
right? Like
the
Eric
Paul Ryan,
Cantor,
right?
Paul Ryan, Kevin McCarthy. So some of them have clearly flamed out.
Yeah.
And now you're kind of seeing that change. The Republican Party is still, like there are still definitely, you know, newer, younger members of the caucus and all of that. But I think you're kind of seeing the Democratic Party a bit catch up with that. But like, I think what you're seeing in the Democratic Party right now is like, you know, the passing of the torch and, you know, a passing of, you know, power influence to a newer generation. And the interesting thing is, like, the Republican Party actually had been better at that for
really?
A long time. Yeah. Like,
okay.
So one of the things was, is like, the way the Democratic Party was set up in Congress is there was a lot of seniority. So it, you know, committee assignments, like being the head of a committee was often based on, okay, who's been here the longest?
Yeah, who's literally and like, just been here?
Yes, okay. Like, have you been here? Great, you're in charge.
It's you, great.
Yes. Okay. And so, like, that was the dynamic, and it still is. You've seen that shaken up a little bit. It's not to say that experienced individuals or older members of Congress shouldn't be there, but I think there's obviously a benefit to, like, a mix of perspectives. And I also think you're seeing organizations that are becoming feeders, you know, like, you know, these activist organizations or individual, like you're seeing a lot of people kind of come from that activist space. Like Maxwell Frost was an activist. Rashida Tlaib, activist. And so you're kind of seeing a new batch of talent kind of grow out of these different spheres that were just kind of not really feeding Congress for a while there. But like the Republican Party had just like a better infrastructure to boost young talent.
Yeah.
Like, look, Elise Stefanik is 38 years old, and she is the third most powerful person in Congress right now.
Wow.
You know, she's the third ranking in Republican leadership. So, like, that's young. Like,
yeah, that's young, yeah.
The average age of a member of Congress is, like, twice that.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So that's still happening. I mean, I do think George Santos has gotten, like, a lot of the clicks and a lot of the press thus far for being sort of young and maybe insane. But there are other there are other people, you know, across the aisle, I guess, that young and are making waves within the party, which is, I think, important to remember and to consider, to think about.
Right. Yeah, like, Stefanik was the youngest woman ever elected to Congress until AOC came along. So it's like it's happening on both sides. And I think that that's a really positive thing for both parties, that you are kind of seeing, again, it's just like a mix of perspectives. Like we're different. Like Maxwell Frost is going to have different life experiences than Nancy Pelosi, like full stop.
Yeah.
You know?
100%. Inside the Hive will be back in just a moment.
How old, if ever, is too old for national office?
This current Congress is the oldest Congress in U.S. history.
I think we already have quite a serious issue with the gerontocracy.
I hear this word thrown around a lot, gerontocracy, right? To sort of describe our political state. And not to sound ageist, because I'm not ageist, we're not ageist, but is that a term that's being thrown around in the halls of D.C.?
Yeah, I mean, I think, so Webster's Dictionary defines gerontocracy.
Yeah, what is a gerontocracy?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So it's basically like a government run by older people.
Yes,
like
old
that
people,
is
old people in charge.
Yeah, so Joe Biden is 80 years old. It is fair to say that Congress is old.
Yeah, like, Joe Biden, oldest president of all time.
Yeah, so people do talk about this, and they talk about this idea of like gerontocracy, but the thing is I think it's changing. I think that's shifting. And I think, you know, one of the really interesting things that you see right now in the Democratic Party is Nancy Pelosi has been challenged. Like, it's not as though, like, every time, you know, every cycle of Congress, it wasn't that, like, it was a given.
Yeah.
I mean, it pretty much was a given. But, like, she was always challenged. Like, people questioned, like, when are you going to step down? When are you going to step aside?
Totally.
Like, this has been an ongoing conversation forever, and you know, she kept it. Like, she kept the leadership. You know, she was speaker or minority leader for decades. And I think one of the things that's so fascinating about this moment is that there has been this passing of the torch to mm-hmm. Hakeem Jeffries. Mm. And you're seeing that shift. Obviously, Joe Biden is still president, but we touched on this idea of, you know, his policies and his legislation and sort of how progressive it has been. Like, yeah. people say all the time, they're like, Joe Biden has been the most progressive president since FDR.
Oldest and most progressive. You don't normally think of those as going hand in hand. And yet,
I think you're seeing a shift in terms of, okay, who are these members of Congress listening to? Like, what are mm-hmm. the issues? You know, what are they pushing? Like, what is the type of legislation that they're passing? And I don't think it's as reflective of, like, you know, the median age of Congress yeah. anymore. And I think you're really sort of seeing this generational shift with, like, mm-hmm. Jeffries and, you know, fresh leadership on the Democratic side.
Totally. It's funny. I mean, it's crazy. I feel crazy that I'm about to say this, but, you know, 2024 is coming, right? It's like, it's...
the I'm shaking my
Abby
head.
Is shaking her head. Just shaking her head. No. But
well, it is terrifying that, like, we're off to the race. Like, 2024 is upon us.
It's
like,
upon us.
You know, Nikki Haley is in the race. Like,
Ron DeSantis.
Like, you know, you have folks hopping in. Like, we're back, guys. Yeah. Like, regularly scheduled programming. But I think what is interesting is, you know, during the last presidential cycle when Biden was, back, like, when he first got his nomination, like, when there was, like, you know, the messy Democratic
yes,
primary.
All of the candidates.
What you saw was a real unification of the Democratic Party behind him. Like, mm-hmm. you had Buttigieg hop behind him. You had Elizabeth Warren get behind him. And, like, very notably, you had Bernie Sanders get behind him.
Yes.
And it really married these different parts of the Democratic Party. And it was really important. And it played a huge role in his victory in his election. But what you also saw is, since Biden has been in office, the fact that the party kind of unified behind him, that Bernie Sanders got behind him, all of these things have been reflected in what he's done
yeah.
as president. I mean, obviously, during the pandemic, you saw very progressive legislation being passed. Mm-hmm. Democrats had, you know, they had the House, the Senate, and the presidency. You get stuff done. You get stuff done when you don't have a divided government. And so you really saw that. And I think his legislative achievements to date are really reflective of the fact that the party is becoming increasingly progressive. But also, like, what are the power centers? Like,
yeah.
who are these voters? You know, young voters are very important. And they're going to be, you know, interested in things like student debt relief.
Yes.
And insurance. You know,
and,
so it's definitely reflected in sort of what we've seen Biden do. And I think, you know, he's been applauded, like, across the party spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the big tent is, like, you know, behind him.
It's behind him. I think it's important for me and for people to not necessarily associate, like, age with a lack of progressivism or getting things done.
Mm-hmm. And when you look at the presidential race so far, like, people are just kind of waiting to see, like, what Biden does.
I mean, I have to imagine, like, capturing the youth vote, capturing the Maxwell Frost of the world is going to be crucial mm-hmm. to winning the election, to getting reelected.
Well, I think, you know, what we saw in the midterms was very indicative of what we're likely to see again. I think people turned out. Abortion mm. was obviously a huge issue.
Mm.
And it's still going to be a huge issue.
Absolutely.
Like, that's not going away. And, like, I'm genuinely a little confused as to, like, what the Republican Party is doing
yeah.
in that regard. Like, the midterms happened and there was no red wave. It was a ripple because of abortion. And then they're like, yep, cool, got it. And they're like, also more yeah.
anti-abortion legislation. That's
they're
what,
like,
the people want.
They're like, good call. They're like, thanks for the analysis. But
actually, we're going to go in a different direction. We're actually
yes.
going to try this again. It's like, don't.
As long as, you know, conservative lawmakers continue at this clip of mm-hmm. increasing restrictions on abortion, what I think you're going to see is, you know, more of this motivation behind the youth, behind voters.
That kind of ties back into sort of what makes Maxwell Frost special.
I do think he is kind of like the future of what you're going to see from the Democratic Party. And that's what other members were saying. That was, like, you know, when people talk about it, they're like, yeah, this is the next generation.
This episode of Inside the Hive was produced by Will Coley. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer. We had engineering assistance from Jake Loomis and Jennifer Nelson. For more news from Inside the Hive, be sure to sign up for our newsletter at vanityfair.com/newsletter/hive.
And let us know what you thought of this episode, or if you have any comments or questions, tweet us while it's still possible. I'm at Abigail Tracy.
And I'm at Chris Triss. Join us again next week for another episode of Inside the Hive, where Wall Street, Washington, and Silicon Valley meet.